everybody. Welcome to Three Guys and a Data Model. Today we have around the table
Chris
and Dave
and Sonia.
And I'm Taylor. So today's topic is explain it to an English major. And this topic mostly came to fruition because of me. I'm Scale's office administrator and I'm studying English in college. Being that I'm more right brain oriented, even though I've been here for about a year, the world of like tech and integration is completely new to me, and I sometimes don't understand everything that goes on in the office behind the scenes. And even though I've been part of discussions involving terminology like data architecture and hypermodels, I'll sit here and look at all the engineers around me and go, what on earth am I doing here? So I thought that maybe this podcast would be a good idea to kind of educate me a little bit and maybe some of the less tech-oriented minds out there listening to the podcast. So my first question for everybody is, what is it that Scale does, maybe on simplest terms?
It might be helpful, actually, to start with our mission, because I don't know that we've really talked about that. Basically, our mission is to revolutionize the way that we integrate. When I say we, I mean literally across multiple industries.
Yeah.
And the way that we do that is basically leveraging kind of the passion and the integrity of our team, which is, those are some key characteristics of our team that we feel are really unique. And we provide architecture solutions that advance critical technologies specifically that protect, save, and improve lives. So we do that through extensive R&D, research and development, which leads to products and methodologies that enable rapid integration of very different technologies. So those very different technologies can be devices, they can be systems, they can be software, so that they basically can all talk to one another in real time, so they can communicate with one another, those different technologies can communicate with one another in real time. But not only that, our solutions help to solve the problem of integratability at scale, allowing these systems of systems to grow, expand over time. Dave, you were here from kind of the beginning of Scale, so maybe you can talk a little bit about that problem, the problem of scale.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely touched on a lot of different even keywords in what you're saying and our mission, and that is definitely something that's super critical to us, is making sure we kind of stay on point with those missions and with that mission and kind of bring it forward. But really, when we look at what the actual problem was, and we kind of started Scale and we started interacting with different customers and different systems, and as you use the term systems of systems and so forth, you know, to kind of break that down a little bit simpler, you really were starting to see that, and as industry and as progress has continued over the years, the more and more computer systems out there are needing to talk to each other. So early on in years 10, 20, 30 years ago, there may have been a few computer systems that actually needed to talk to each other, and you could basically make that happen pretty easily. But as everybody knows, you know, we're starting to see a lot more technology start being involved, whether it be your cell phones or you know, drones, for example, or your smart home or anything along those lines. We have more and more computer systems that are trying to talk to each other. And as new companies come up with new ideas and new devices and new kinds of computer systems, all of those things then need to talk to everything else. And this becomes a massive problem, because now it would be as though you were having a party and every single new person that entered that party was talking a different language. Now suddenly that person needs to start communicating with everybody else in that party. Well, you may need to have some kind of translation that happens between them, where somebody else enters the room. Well, now you have three different languages speaking at the same time, and more people kind of enter that room and enter that party. They all start needing to talk to each other, and that gets very, very complex. And while we have ways of actually doing that, they're very hard ways, they're difficult ways. And that's kind of, as the industry's been growing, that's what we've been doing. And from our standpoint, from Scale's standpoint, it's really looking, how can we solve that problem better? As these new people start entering into the party, how do we get them talking easier, faster, cheaper, as we move kind of forward with that?
So when we say integration, we're not talking about a social movement. We're talking about making computer systems talk to other computer systems and make them work with each other. So Dave, that was a great example with the party. But, you know, what if you are on a computer network or you're in an aircraft and you bring a new piece of equipment to bear? You know, you buy a new radio, you get your new in-flight entertainment system, whatever it is. Well, how do you make that piece of hardware or software or whatever work as a part of the overall system? And how do you make sure that it doesn't break things that have been done already. So those are the kinds of problems that we touch on when we're dealing with integration.
Now, I have a question going back to what both you and Dave were asking, because, you know, I think of, well, what if everybody at the party, we just told them all that they all just needed to learn the same language. We just said, you know, yeah, I know your native tongue is French or Swahili or whatever, but in order to be able to make this work, before you enter the room, just speak a different language. Is that one of the integration solutions that's currently out there? And why don't we just do that?
So we typically refer to that as solving integration through commonality, right? Let's make everybody common. Unfortunately, and this is where we get a little bit mathy, we talk about the lowest common denominator. So what's the one common thing that we all do? And then what happens is, Taylor, you have your special thing that you do. Well, how do you do your special thing when we don't do your special thing? And then Sonia has her special thing. And Dave doesn't have a special thing, but he has the thing that he does differently. You know, commonality gets you a certain path, you know, it's a certain distance down the road, but it's far from an ideal solution. And oftentimes, what ends up happening is a standard or an approach that's built on commonality. They usually have this thing called a, user-defined message or a private message or sending, you know, an extension that really just opens the door for people to put their own information out there and no longer be commonly integrated.
My initial question after listening to all three of your explanations is, I am a visual person, so is there a way that you can visually paint what data architecture and this integration looks like for me so I can understand it? But it kind of sounds like you're building bridges between things.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
That's very good. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, going back to the party in terms of what Chris was just saying, I'm imagining, you know, we say that people in Alaska have, I don't know how many different words for snow, right? That might be that special thing that Chris is talking about when we're talking about people being able to communicate. But if we speak a common language, they might lose 40 of those words for snow that, you know, that they would not be able to define. And so then, therefore, we'd be creating an add-on. People in Alaska would need to create an add-on to be able to cover those 40 different words for snow, and then we're no longer speaking a common language. I think would that be a decent example?
Yeah. And I don't think we can have a meaningful discussion about integration until we really ask why, right? There has to be an overarching business driver. Why would some people start a company just to go after integration? What's the business driver? And there was a recent briefing a year or two ago, and the information that was presented, they basically said that it is cheaper to go out and buy a whole new system. And when they're talking about systems, they're not talking about a new computer for your office. They're talking about a new $100 million platform, aircraft, ship, something like that, rather than to integrate new stuff onto an existing platform. So the cost of integration is skyrocketing. It's consuming massive amounts of money. So how do we affect the cost of integration? And of course, that means we have to understand the problems that are typically associated with integration so we can bring down that cost.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Scale is doing.
Right.
That's exactly what Scale is doing.
We have solutions. We've upfront, we spent a lot of time and energy in R&D, and we still are doing that as well to continue to push the envelope, but that's where, you know, our solutions that we currently have in place have come from. They've come from this kind of origin story of this problem of scaling, of making, of, you know, what Dave was talking about, what Chris was talking about in terms of integrating more and more things as, you know, the world progresses with its technological advancements. We need to do that more quickly, cheaper, and very effectively.
Well, in almost a way, I know, Chris, you mentioned just the cost and just the expense of doing that, but even what you just said, Sonia, too, of just being able to do it quickly.
Yeah.
You know, especially when we're on a mission-critical type of systems, especially when we're talking defense-related or anything that's going to have a high volatility to it. You know, the amount of time it takes to do that, to bring in a new system, you know, you don't want to be waiting a year and a half to bring in a new system because it takes that long to get everything talking to each other. Because now, once you're a year and a half later, well, now you're already out of date, you know, by that time, as soon as you actually have it running. So you kind of end up in this problem of never being able to catch up because you can't do it fast enough.
My next question is, who is this technology useful to? Who utilizes this?
Yeah.
Is it the daily user? Is it somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, good question. So we think, you know, the kind of end user sort of sitting at their computer, you know, at home, is not necessarily they may be the end consumer of a lot of this technology, but primarily, you know, we're looking at some big industry and big industry players who have, are managing these large system of systems, which means lots of systems and devices and softwares together. And if it sounds like what we're talking about is really widely applicable, it is. It's very broadly applicable because it is a foundational concept, foundational technology. So when people talk about Internet of Things, IoT, or Industrial Internet of Things, IIoT, you know, all of that, those are big buzzwords right now, all of that, what we're talking about applies. It's absolutely applicable. It's making all of our devices, you know, communicate with one another.
So maybe to further break down that question, who is currently using this and who could use it down the road?
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, as Chris alluded to earlier, and Dave as well, that there are lots of different solutions for integrating out there right now, but there are a lot of problems with those solutions. They're not... you know, the integrating by commonality has its problems, as we discussed. These solutions tend to be very slow, very painful, and incredibly expensive. So the solutions that we have in place that we've developed really, you know, this could be broadly applicable in pretty much any industry. That said, we are focusing on really, really large, complex systems of systems where, as I mentioned earlier with the mission statement, are specifically designed to protect, save, and improve lives. So what we're calling mission-critical systems, that's what we mean. We mean they protect and save lives.
And a lot of times that does kind of intersect, you know, not necessarily a certain company or a certain, you know, business, but rather, as somebody was talking about, like an actual industry, you know, a certain, you know, kind of grouping of an industry that can be targeted and can kind of implement that, those solutions together to kind of have that, just all of that come together for their, for that. You know, one of those is obviously defense. You know, we've already talked about that a couple of times. Chris talked about it. I did, you know, so whether or not, you know, our personal clients, whether or not we've worked with the Army or the Navy, you know, the Air Force, of course, you know, NATO, and then outside of defense, I think we also have some intersections there.
So we also, some other areas that we're highly focused in are healthcare. So that would mean hospitals. Hospitals have lots of devices, lots of systems, lots of software, definitely mission critical stuff. Nursing homes, assisted care. Working with, you know, devices like an insulin pump is a fantastic example. You know, there are automated insulin pumps that will check an individual's insulin level, their blood sugar, and go ahead and automatically pump, you know, insulin into that body. Great examples of mission critical systems. Another area is smart cities and the Internet of Things, as I mentioned. We are very involved with the NIST Global Smart Cities Challenge. That covers a variety of industries within a smart city.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of energy, power grid. It's mission critical, right? Power goes down at a hospital. Power goes down at you know, certain plants and manufacturing plants. That can be dangerous. So energy, public safety, transportation, traffic, water, disaster response. There's a lot of different areas that particular concept of IoT and smart cities touch, but all of those are ones that we're looking at as well.
Yeah, the truth is that whenever we talk to someone in a new industry, they immediately identify with the fact that they have their own integration challenges. I've spoken with some local food manufacturers. They immediately see how they could have need some help. with solving some of their integration. You know, they buy a new company. How do we make our equipments work together? We've talked with insurance companies. How do we get, and I think largely we tend to think of like medical insurance. How do we even get our diagnostic codes to line up? That in and of itself, even though they're generally prescribed, and you know they're managed by a common standard, the internal representations aren't exactly the same. We spoke early on in our life with someone who had a much deeper business background, pure business, and Sonia, even early when we spoke with you, there was a large mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah.
You know, oh, we can solve a lot of mergers and acquisitions problems with scales technology. Financial markets, there are different things that that they don't connect well there. So what we've had to do is pick an industry where we can grow up, grow our technology, and mature as a company. And really what we did is we started in an industry that we knew from where we came from, at least some of us, in earlier parts of our career, which is why we have a lot of customers in the defense industry. With it being defense, they're actually a little more tolerant of some more radical R&D as a customer. In the market, customers, how many times have you downloaded an app that it just didn't work quite right, so you threw it away? Like, yeah, there's another app that does something close to that. So we don't want to be dismissed early in the market because, you know, the market can be very demanding, you know, the consumer market. So we're dealing with customers that are a little more tolerant of research and allowing us to build our technology out.
I feel like it's probably a unique thing how far-reaching the solutions that you offer here are. I feel like that's not an everyday thing, how it can affect every facet of life everywhere.
Because it is, it's as you said earlier, it's kind of like they're bridges, right? And bridges can get you from any one place to any other place. The place doesn't really matter. We're building the architecture. We're building the, it's the infrastructure architecture that gets you from place to place.
And this is like a brand new thing. Nobody else is doing this like you are.
Not like we are. There are other solutions out there, but the way that we're putting it all together is unique.
Yeah, the combination of just some philosophies that we use in order to build those, you know, to put that infrastructure in place and some of those tools and techniques, are very, very unique and specific to what we do.
That's incredible. So when you talk about different devices and systems being interconnected, how they communicate with each other through this data architecture that we've been talking about, how does this data architecture differ from the internet? Because when I envision connection, I envision things like Wi-Fi, and why is this different from something that I already use?
Sure. We get back to, when we do talk about data architecture, we're kind of even coming up one level a little bit, and we're really talking about the essentially the building blocks of how information is actually structured, how it's communicated, how pieces of information are put together to mean something else. So if you were to think about building a house, sorry, I'm going to go with all analogy everywhere on this one, but you know, if you're building, I like analogies. So, so if you're building a house, there are certain components, there are certain building blocks that make up that house. You may be just buying the house, but you know, you're buying windows and you're buying doors and you're buying floors and walls and maybe even furniture that are put together to build that house. They're the actual, and within those walls, maybe there's actually bricks that make the walls that you're buying that are part of the house. So there's actually kind of a well-formed structure. And even similar to with English, you know, as you have actual sentence construction, right? You have rules of construction that are made to say, okay, I know that this is how a sentence is structured. So I can understand what that sentence actually means because of the way those words are placed within that sentence. Now those structure of that sentence may be different in a different language even, right? So if you're talking, you know, French, or you know, they may have a different structure of how they build their sentences, but yet they still have a structure, right? And so because that data art, so essentially that becomes that architecture of how a sentence is built. If you can understand how that sentence is built and you kind of get that language, we can now have a conversation, right? So when we talk about data architecture, we're talking about really data, meaning really data about anything. If it's smart homes, if it's that insulin pump kind of reading, it might be the the temperature sensor that's been used to take that person's temperature when it relates to that insulin pump. We're talking in that medical kind of realm. Smart cities, it may be your light switch is it on or is it off? There's a certain message that comes from that something else has to understand, right? So there's just structure around that of like, oh, a light is this, a light switch is this, you know. When we get to defense, we're talking the same, it's really the same thing. This gets back to your previous question of the different industries of defense. It's the same way. It's still an aircraft is flying at a certain speed, you know. Well, something on the ground needs to know that it's flying at a certain speed. So there's a certain structure, a data architecture around that information that helps me understand, or one thing understand, what the other thing is doing or saying or reading. So it's kind of, that's how data architecture is. It's just a way to structure that information in a way that it makes sense to someone who's looking at that.
Well, so let me jump onto that. What we're doing at scale is not just documenting this information so that a person can read it, but we're documenting it in such a way that a computer can read it. Okay? And we're not doing sophisticated artificial intelligence, because in a lot of places where you use AI, you're using probabilities. And you'll say, well, when you spoke to Siri, I'm about 95% sure you said the word blah, but maybe it comes out as block, because who says blah? But over time, as you say blah and correct block to blah a lot, it learns, oh, well, Taylor really likes to say blah. So the next time you say block, it puts blah in there, right? But that's why, yes, AI is very powerful. It is great for learning, but we don't always want it making mission-critical type decisions.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we're focused on those mission-critical industries, because our technology is based on mathematical principles rather than AI.
Correct.
Safer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and we like to use a word called deterministic, meaning you know what it's going to do. So a lot of our time is spent thinking about, well, what does it mean when I get this information from a computer? Now you say, well, isn't that written down somewhere? And the truth is that yes, it is. And I think we've probably talked about this before, but when you write documentation, when you write English, you have to be very careful with the words you pick, because sometimes words have different meanings, and sometimes how you read a word depends on, you know, personal bias. Mm-hmm. Right, so there's connotation and denotation and all of those fun things. So you read a sentence and you mistake it for meaning something else. And even though the author was well-intentioned to communicate an idea clearly, for some reason, they never predicted that you would be reading it. And they didn't know what biases you carried around, and that you would misinterpret their sentence. And this has happened to us in class, where we have carefully constructed answers to be one thing, and someone read it differently.
They're not the training classes, right?
Yeah, these are classes where scale has gone out and trained others in data architecture. So we're using very formal methods and processes to capture that documentation.
So the computer, the computer never misunderstands it.
That's right, so computers can calculate it. If there's an error, it's because people put in wrong information, right? Another thing you mentioned is, well, we have the internet. Why doesn't that solve all of our problems? Well, the internet provides physical connectivity, and so does Wi-Fi. Yeah, I don't have a cable going into my computer when I'm using Wi-Fi, but I have this what they call link level communication, meaning I have a connection to another machine that allows me to communicate with the world. But what is the structure of that data that I'm sending back and forth? What does that data mean? So if we go all the way down to super techie land, you have zeros and ones, basically. And they're not even zeros and ones. It's just signals that are changing on the wire, right? If it's If it's fiber optics, you've got light on and off. If it's a copper wire, you've got voltage on and off, right? It's just very, very raw. So we convert these zeros and ones into numbers. So maybe you're sending 98.6 to me. You type in 98.6, you hit enter, and voila, a few pieces of information show up on my computer. Well, if I use artificial intelligence, which many might argue is about the closest my brain comes to intelligence, I might infer that you're telling me your body temperature.
That was my first thought.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but why? I mean, we haven't had a conversation. See, we have some notion of context, and that's a magic number that means something. But, you know, if you'd said 98.5, that could have just as easily been a radio station. So we make these guesses, and we're always doing this. We don't want to do that with our data. And when I get a number without having context, I don't know what that number means.
So you provide the context.
Well, we provide a system for capturing all of the meaning. So is 98.6 even a temperature? We need to know if it's a temperature. We need to know if it's in Celsius or Fahrenheit. Because if it's in Fahrenheit, you're healthy. If it's in Celsius, you're boiling. Right? We need to know what it's the temperature of. Is it the temperature of Taylor?
Or because it could be the temperature of the coffee, which then Celsius suddenly makes sense.
Absolutely. But if it's the temperature of my car's engine, then that's probably way too low to be useful.
So what you're saying is the difference between this technology and then the internet is that the internet doesn't provide this context that you do?
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It provides just
a means for data transfer.
It provides the connectivity. It's the link connectivity.
And you're doing both?
Well, we leverage the connections that are provided by the internet and those technologies. So we can use Wi-Fi. We can use the cable, you know, the plugs that you plug into your computer. It's called Ethernet. We can use other things. We can use carrier pigeon, in theory.
But then it would be essentially using that same pipe, that same, you know, link to say, okay, this is the temperature of your coffee in Celsius, you know, at this time. It all now is part of what comes across in that message, rather than you just getting 98.6.
Or
so it's more,
and it doesn't have to be in the message,
mm-hmm.
right? It's present when you integrate.
Yeah.
So you are receiving a temperature, or you are sending a temperature. I'm receiving a temperature, mm-hmm. or actually, I'm receiving zeros and ones. You're sending zeros and ones. What did you mean by this collection of zeros and ones? And your documentation tells me. Well, what Dave is saying, and what's better, is your documentation allows your computer to tell my computer what that means. Mm-hmm. And then it can be presented to me mm-hmm. in the proper format. So the internet, we use browsers all day long, right? We go to Google and we type in a search term and we get these brilliant little answers that tells all sorts of things. There's very little that tells us what those things mean, or rather tells the computer what those things mean. We have things called HTML and we have things called CSS that are very narrowly scoped languages that tell your browser how to draw the information, but there's still a human sitting there reading the web page. Wikipedia, not super useful to just a computer sitting there learning. Mm-hmm. You know, unless we're doing deep learning AI things.
Yeah, somebody actually uses the information.
So I'm trying a new analogy out, and I haven't really played this fully through, see if it's right or not. But so it's almost like if we think about architecture, some people talk about network architecture, which would be more of like the internet and the wiring and mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing, versus what we're talking about, which is data architecture. Would it be, it's almost like the network architecture is sort of the paper and the pen, And what we're dealing with in terms of data architecture is more of what's actually being written and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's the physical. It may not be a physical. It might be a Wi-Fi connection, but it's still much more in the physical realm.
Mm-hmm.
That network architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we're actually dealing with the what we call syntax and semantics, which is the data and the meaning of that data.
So it's not the book; it's the words.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. It's not the book; it's the words. It's not the paper and pen and that allows that
right.
the words to be written. It's the actual words and
right.
the meaning.
That makes sense.
It may be presented on a website, it may be presented in a newspaper, it may be presented in
right.
a book.
It could be presented in all kinds of places, but we're dealing with the,
yeah.
the data architecture, the words themselves.
Yeah.
No matter how they're translated, how they're transferred.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's helpful. It only took me a year to get all that. do we have any last thoughts, questions before we wrap up?
Mm-hmm. I think that
no,
kind of covers from my end.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. That was very helpful.
Yeah.
I hope that everybody listening learned a little bit, too. Thank you for joining us. Mm-hmm.